All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy. The content is intended purely as an expression of personal opinion.
The modern environmentalist movement is actually pagan worship, where they worship the sun, so they like solar. They worship Gaia, Mother Nature. They want degrowth, and they hate humans, right? They see humans as a form of cancer on Earth. They want to see the population decrease. They're just a lunatic religion that's not grounded in enlightenment values of human dignity and reason. Proof of stake, I think, is fine for community coin like Ethereum, where they all know each other and they're all friends. Bitcoin is a system for adversaries. Anybody who paid taxes for the invasion of Iraq, should they be liable for the tremendous environmental damage and human cost, right? I think 1 million Iraqis died. I think that's a much more pertinent question than early Bitcoin adopters paying for fabricated fake environmental damage. And so preventing theft by being seizure resistant is actually a good property of Bitcoin, and it's something we should celebrate.
Welcome to All in Bitcoin, Pierre. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, CK.
Before we get into All Bitcoin and more, I would like to warm up and get to know you a little bit better with my 21 takes on Pierre.
Okay.
What were the topics of conversation at the dinner table at home?
So my parents did talk about politics at the dinner table, and they also talked about banks and currencies and the stock market, because my dad worked in semiconductors for a publicly traded company, and so I would hear about the stock options and what the market was doing. And then because we were moving between France and Scotland and the U.S., I'd hear about currency conversion and topics like that. I think that's probably maybe the seed of where I got interested in a topic like Bitcoin.
I was going to ask you, who or what pulled you into Bitcoin?
Yeah, so, on top of just growing up in that context, I also became very interested in software and open source software and free software in high school. So I would listen to Richard Stallman lectures where he would talk about the philosophy of why users should have access to the source code. And I thought that was very compelling, and I would go and try to install Linux on my parents' old computers. And then I got interested in Austrian economics. I'd go to Wikipedia quite often, and one day on Wikipedia, they had a featured article of anarcho-capitalism. And when I read that article, I found it very compelling. It drove me to Mises.org, which is a think tank that focuses on Austrian economics. I started learning about money and banking and the fractional reserve banking and full reserve banking and gold and silver and fiat. Then in 2012, I was at the University of Texas at Austin, and two of my friends, Michael Goldstein and Daniel Krawis, they were really interested in Bitcoin. And so they brought it up and orange-pilled me and led me down the rabbit hole of learning about Bitcoin. It made a lot of sense to me that with 21 million Bitcoin, it's better than gold and it's open source. So I don't have to trust it. I can, actually see the source code for myself, see what it does. That would, make it such that Bitcoin's adoption would be far greater than any other kind of political reforms that libertarians would advocate for with regards to the monetary system.
At what age did you start reading about money?
Yeah, so this was my sophomore year of high school. So I guess I was, 15.
Wow, yeah. That's fairly early.
Yeah, I got lucky. I mean, thank God I came across that topic pretty early, and I was kind of just intrinsically interested in it.
Donald Trump.
Yes.
What would you say?
It's funny. In high school, I remember my last year of high school, I took a business class, and the business class turned out to just be watching The Apprentice. That was my first introduction to Donald Trump, was watching The Apprentice in high school. I liked him because he kind of shares my sense of humor, which is kind of tongue-in-cheek. Sometimes you can't tell if he's joking or not, but he's like half joking, half serious. And you know, he'll speak in hyperboles, and that some people, like, they don't, that doesn't connect with them. I thought it was great. And he's somebody who's clearly driven and wants to do things in the world rather than working on other people's ideas.
What drives you totally insane?
Right now, it's really around environmentalism. So I think that the environmentalist movement has been hijacked by the carbon cult that wants to use carbon emissions and global warming as a way of controlling the global economy, and that's their priority, rather than having a priority of let's improve the environment and let's clean it up. Because I think that there's lots of forms of pollution that are far easier to address than carbon emissions. So, for example, seed oils in our food are pollution, right? You've got people who are feeding their children engine oil, and people are getting sick from all of this. You've got an obesity epidemic. It's having just tremendous, devastating costs on society today. And then they're obsessed with carbon emissions in 2050. You've got microplastics. So just tiny pieces of plastic in the food supply that we're all eating. We're eating microplastics. Terrible form of pollution. Not a priority. No, the priority is making sure that you don't use electricity because of the indirect carbon emissions. So that I think, is what drives me crazy. I think that because the way that we address all the forms of real pollution is through technological progress, through increased energy use, and plenty of countries, whether it's France or the United States, struggle with the problem of litter, right? Trash out in the streets. And what we need are robots that automatically go around and pick up the trash, right? And that takes up technology and that takes up lots of electricity, but it's good for the environment. And so the modern environmentalist movement is actually a form of pagan worship, where they worship the sun, so they like solar. They worship Gaia, Mother Nature. They want degrowth, and they hate humans, right? They see humans as a form of cancer on Earth, and that they want to see the population decrease. And so I think that they're just kind of a lunatic religion that's not grounded in enlightenment values of human dignity and reason.
Well said.
Thank you.
Who can chill you out when you are carried away?
That's my wife. She's my better half, right? And so she balances me out. Otherwise, I would go totally crazy. Yeah.
If you could trade lives with anyone for a day, who would be at the very bottom of your list?
Mm. Well, there's a lot of people there. Maybe at the very bottom of that list. I feel like what's developed into my nemesis is Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like maybe she would be at the bottom of my list. At the same time, though, I mean, I think that it's really important to love our neighbors and to love our enemies. And so maybe it would be good for me to spend some time in her shoes and to get her perspective. I recently was in Las Vegas, and it's very depressing to see people at the slot machine, you know, just mindlessly pressing the slot machine button. That looks like hell. Yeah.
Any passions outside Bitcoin?
Yeah, I love electronics. I enjoy programming a lot. And so most recently I've been building a remote control car. I love like tinkering and kind of the maker movement. Something I'd like to get into eventually is like 3D printing, and that part really I find fascinating.
If you could change one thing about Bitcoin, what would it be?
That's a great question. So I think the most controversial, instead of having every 4 years, having every 1 year.
Okay.
So that more Bitcoin would have been issued up front. And today we would have less issuance. It would be a much smaller Bitcoin mining industry, much smaller energy use for Bitcoin mining, and perhaps a higher price. And so that's probably the most controversial take I have on something to change about Bitcoin. I think less controversial would be that I'd love for Bitcoin Core, the desktop software that has the node and the wallet, for it to be plug and play with hardware wallets. I know people are working on it, but if there's one thing I could have today, that would be it. Yeah,
I think I would go for a little bit more of privacy. No,
I've never had an issue with that. Like, I've never had somebody come up and tell me, "Hey, I know your Bitcoin." I hear people, say that it's a problem, but I guess I haven't experienced it firsthand, so it's not a priority. I also think that Lightning has great privacy. There's always room for improvement. I don't think that it's as big of a problem as it's often seen as.
What's your latest obsession?
I'm building this remote control car, and then I start learning about these remote control airplanes that have extremely powerful motors on them. They can go 100 miles per hour. So I've been obsessing over reading about them. That's the latest obsession, yeah.
Are you a shower or a teller?
I'm a teller, yeah. I can talk for a long time. The first time I came to El Salvador, I provided a 5-hour lecture on Bitcoin mining. So now there is a show element to that, in the sense that I always come with slides. So I love data visualization, and that's something that I'm passionate about, is SQL and Python and getting all the right data to be able to present reality to people.
What's the most exciting moment in your Bitcoin journey so far?
There's the first Bitcoin transaction I did, and then there's the first Lightning payment that I did that were pretty exciting, just in terms of firsthand experience. And then testifying in front of the Texas Senate, that was pretty exciting. So getting in front of a very, well-respected audience and speaking the truth about Bitcoin, I think that's the highlight for me.
Best movie ever?
I used to say V for Vendetta, but as I get older now, I don't see it as, I see it as a more immature movie, to be honest. And as I've gotten older, I've gotten a lot more into religion. So I'd have to say Mel Gibson's Passion movie is the best movie ever.
How come you got into religion?
So it really came with having children that I realized what innocence is, right? And so children are just by their nature the most innocent. They're like 100% innocent. They haven't done anything wrong yet, to their knowledge, right? They don't know any better. And then it made me realize how much guilt I'm carrying around as an adult. And that, when I read the story of Jesus Christ, that speaks to me of, okay, hey, you don't have to carry that guilt around. You can be forgiven. You can just let that go, and then you can live. And I think that's really important for folks to understand.
The last good book you've read?
I just finished reading a biography of St. Catherine of Siena.
Okay.
also on the same topic of religion. People like to talk about religious people who are hypocrites, right? Who say one thing and then they do something bad. And, doesn't that prove that religion is bad? But when we look at all of the saints and all of the lives of the saints, we have to recognize that there are religious people who have lived out their religion in the most extraordinary forms possible. And that, it's something that we can learn from.
What's the one thing about Bitcoin that most people think they understand, but actually get completely wrong?
Okay, so that one is with Bitcoin mining. So people say, Bitcoin mining secures the network, right? It's a phrase that I hear all the time. It's completely false. It's Bitcoin nodes that can secure the network in any meaningful sense of the term. Bitcoin miners have a very narrow role in the system, and they propose blocks to the nodes, but by no means are they the ones setting the rules or even verifying the rules. They're the ones operating within the rules, just like a Bitcoin wallet would. And so I think that's the biggest misconception out there.
How do you chill and avoid burning out?
Yeah, that's a good question. Goes back to religion again, prayer. I think that's a great way. I mean, you know, for people who are not into like organized religion, they, you know, meditation and the sauna, because of all the microplastics in our food, we've got to sweat them out. And taking breaks, right? So it's not like it feels like I think about Bitcoin 24/7, but I also, you know, take breaks to spend lots of time with my family and to spend time on other hobbies like electronics, like, you know, reading and politics. Also, I find politics to be fascinating. So I love to read about politics, understand it, read about history, and then try to influence the political process as well. That's really exciting to me.
Noster.
I think Noster is the, when I think about non-hardware technologies, it's the second most exciting technology, second to Bitcoin. I have done lots of little Python programming projects for myself around Noster. I think that something I want to build, because I'm a Twitter guy, so I'm like obsessed with Twitter. I need to bridge those two, right? And I feel like that there needs to be, ideally, Twitter would join Noster, right? And then I wouldn't need to post twice on both accounts. So it's something I need to be better about, is to post on Noster more than I post on Twitter. And it's challenging because in an ideal world, you know, Elon Musk would not have acquired Twitter, and it would have continued to be worse and worse in terms of censorship. And then more people would have gone to Noster, and it would have driven the growth of Noster. But because Elon Musk did something really virtuous, which was to acquire Twitter and to give it free speech, I think that it actually took demand away from Noster, ironically.
Your non-negotiables?
I think an adherence to the truth. I try to never lie. You know, if I ever do, just call me out. Yeah, I think that's the most important.
Well, thanks for sharing, Pierre. Yeah. Now I want to talk with you about common myths and misconceptions about Bitcoin. I think it's very important to clarify these misunderstandings. So let's start with Bitcoin transactions are anonymous and cannot be traced.
They are pseudonymous, and Satoshi really explains kind of the privacy model for Bitcoin in the white paper. And when we look at the development of tracing software like Chainalysis, what they rely on is getting third-party data. So they don't just look at the blockchain, they also get data from exchanges in order to be able to correlate on-chain activity with real-world identities. And so it's pseudonymous, but that can be pierced due to the fact that people will use KYC, AML, you know, exchanges and tie their identities to addresses. Even if you have your identity tied to one address, if you go and spend that Bitcoin, and you might actually be sending it back to yourself to a new address, but there's no way for a third party to know if you sent it to your own address or to a third party, and that you spent the Bitcoin, right? So, or that you got hacked, right? And so I think that there's lots of nuance to it, and that unfortunately what we've seen is courts don't quite understand the nuances of the tracing technology, and they ascribe more confidence to it than they ought to.
Bitcoin harms the economic stability of the USA and the dollar.
It's like, okay, if you have Netflix and you have Blockbuster and Netflix is doing well and it's taking market share away from Blockbuster, then yeah, it does undermine the stability of Blockbuster. And that in any kind of historical technological shift, you know, whether it's from railroads to cars or from horses to cars, that the incumbents lose market share and are destabilized by a new technology. And then it's a question of, from a policy perspective, do we want to try to stop innovation and stop people from using a better system in order to lock them into legacy proprietary systems? Or do we want to give people consumer choice and let them decide what's best for their life? Second of all, there's the question of what is the US dollar doing wrong, right? And the US dollar has been sabotaging itself repeatedly through bailouts and through financial crises. And so if bankers and politicians want to defend the US dollar, they have to start holding themselves accountable and stop printing money and actually compete with Bitcoin's monetary policy. But they don't have that kind of self-control. And so they're not really in a position to criticize Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is mainly used by criminals for illicit activities.
When we look at the data, and a lot of this data comes from the folks who are tracing Bitcoin transactions using data from exchanges, it's less than 1% of the activity on chain that is part of criminal activity. And that is actually a much smaller percentage than what we see in the fiat system. Criminals don't like Bitcoin. And in fact, what we've seen is that criminals prefer using stablecoins. Criminals are very short-term thinkers, just by their nature. And so they're interested in quickly converting any asset into consumption. And what we've seen is that the way all the criminals get caught, they somehow steal Bitcoin, and then they transfer it to an exchange, and then the exchange freezes their account, and then the criminal gets caught. I think that there's a lot less criminal activity on Bitcoin and a lot more apprehension because criminals don't want to hold Bitcoin because it's too volatile for them.
Bitcoin will only help tax evaders, leading to a global economic crash.
It's good to help tax evaders on some level, which is that we have to accept that when we look at government spending, it's completely out of control and it is extremely wasteful. It's wasteful not just in the sense that it doesn't accomplish the good that it sets out to accomplish, but it quite often accomplishes evil, right? So when we look, for example, at the Russian invasion of Ukraine, funded by taxes on Russian citizens by the Russian government, it would be good if more Russians evaded taxes so that the Russian war machine would have less resources to spend on the invasion of Ukraine. There's lots of examples we can point to where it's good to help tax evasion and that there's not really a problem here. Now, the other part of it, too, is that we have to think about what is being taxed. What should be taxed is what is actually natural to tax from the perspective of a state, which is a state is a territorial monopoly on the use of violence. And so it's the territory that should be taxed. That means that it makes the most sense to have a property tax. All other forms of taxation are worse, in my mind, than a property tax. Maybe second to a property tax, you know, in terms of preference for me, would be tariffs, because now you're talking about goods and services entering and leaving the territory. But you know, when people complain about tax evasion, quite often it's because they are interested in stealing from others. And I strongly believe that theft is wrong. And so preventing theft by being seizure resistant is actually a good property of Bitcoin. And it's something we should celebrate.
Well said. Bitcoin users are all libertarians or anti-establishment.
I think that's false. And it's false for one reason, which is that everybody needs money, right? And so money is a universal good. It's a very transactional perspective on Bitcoin of thinking about it as purely as a means of payment, a medium of exchange. But the reality is that what everybody gets censored is their savings. And so when we look at the fiat system, perhaps its greatest evil is the inflation that goes on, where they're debasing the currency. And so you can't hold fiat currency, and they're forcing you to either go spend on what I call the high velocity trash economy, where you have to buy low quality goods from China as quickly as possible, and people live paycheck to paycheck. Or they force you to invest in, you know, subprime mortgages and other, you know, bad investments to try to stay ahead of inflation. They do that by debasing the currency. And that has nothing to do with libertarianism. everybody wants to improve their lot in life and give their kids a better life. And so it just makes sense that everybody wants Bitcoin if they understand the problem that it solves.
We don't need Bitcoin since our money is already digital.
That's a very strong argument against digital currencies and in like central bank digital currencies. I think that that's an argument I've actually heard from opponents of CBDCs, that everything's already digital, so it's not a need. I think that's a fine argument, but it misses that, you know, when we think about Bitcoin, it's not just digital, but it's cash. It's electronic cash. And so that's really what makes it so important, is that when you're a part of the Bitcoin network and you're running your own node and you're holding your own keys, you're not just being your own bank, and it's not just digital, you're being your own central bank, and that you're actually plugged into the monetary backbone, and you're a first-class citizen. You're not relying on a third party, and you're not having to trust a third party to be able to accomplish what you want. And so you've got to be digital, but you also have to be permissionless.
On that note, Bitcoin has no utility.
Yeah, so Bitcoin's greatest utility is, I think, twofold. One is the freedom to send and receive, right? So the transactional utility of Bitcoin, and being able to do that globally 24/7 without anybody's permission. And the second utility is long-term savings, being able to transport money through time. And to say that, okay, well, I've put all this energy into saving money by working and spending less than I earn. I need to be able to transport that 30 years into the future. The only money that can do that reliably is Bitcoin. And that's just a tremendous amount of utility. It goes back to a debate in monetary economics that goes back hundreds of years between what's called the banking school and the currency school, where they would debate the utility of money, and that just holding money, they saw that as an activity that would slow down the economy, because now you're not contributing to the velocity of money. You're not contributing to somebody else's income that's going to spend it to move the economy forward. And then the counter to that was that the reason people hold money is to hedge against future uncertainty. And so when you start preventing them from being able to hedge against future uncertainty, then in the future, they won't have the cash that they needed. And then you'll have economic cycles of people cyclically not having enough money and that causing the economy to crash. And I think that on top of that, it has a negative psychological implication. That is that when you don't have the utility of Bitcoin, it's a hedge against uncertainty. Now, suddenly you have neuroses developing of anxiety. Right. And I think modern society is riddled with anxiety, and people are medicating themselves for this. And that perhaps if they had a currency that had the utility of Bitcoin, then they wouldn't have all this anxiety and they wouldn't need their meds.
Bitcoin is worthless because it's not backed by anything.
It's a metaphysical argument, essentially, because it is arguing that Bitcoin exists outside of time and space, because if it did exist within time and space, then it has to be backed by something in the material world, right? And I think that it's mostly from a perspective of people who don't think of computers and software as being real. So when they talk about virtual currency and virtual reality, to them, it's the same as talking about spirituality, right? That it's something that does not exist in the material world and that exists in a different plane of existence. And I also see that as a form of paganism. It's just, it comes down to a lack of education, right? So people don't understand how semiconductors work. They don't understand how electricity works. And so they think that, you know, software is not real. The truth is, software is real. So software exists in a time and place, and it is just as real as gold is, right? And so gold is backed by gold. Bitcoin is backed by software. It's backed by electronics. It's backed by hardware and by electricity. And so there's not really any difference other than one of understanding.
So the value of Bitcoin is based on how much electricity it takes to mine them.
This, I think, is should be reformulated as the amount of electricity it takes to mine them is the result of the value of Bitcoin. And so when the mining reward started out as 50 Bitcoin every 10 minutes in 2009, when Satoshi first launched Bitcoin, the value of Bitcoin was $0. And so even though the mining reward was a lot of Bitcoin, if we multiply it by dollars, zero. And so then the amount of mining that was happening was close to zero. It was Satoshi's computer, which didn't consume a lot of electricity. And as we go further along, the amount of electricity has increased purely due to the fact that the Bitcoin price has increased more quickly than the halvings have occurred. And so, you know, the new issuance gets cut in half every 4 years. If the Bitcoin price goes up by a factor of 10, then the miners are incentivized to compete against each other by plugging in more mining rigs, increasing the hash rate, increasing the energy consumption. And so it's really driven by the value of Bitcoin rather than the reverse.
Early Bitcoiners were unfairly rewarded.
So I have heard a lot of stories from early Bitcoiners who sold too early. And so, you know, they got Bitcoin at $1 and then they sold it at $100. And now it's at $90,000. So it's in some ways, it's a relay race, right? Where they feel like, okay, they got their gains, they're cashing out, they're handing the baton to the next generation. And you can see that phenomenon on chain. So there's what's called HODL waves, where you see people buy Bitcoin during the bear market and then they sell it during the bull market. But they are terrible at timing, and so the price will keep going, and so they'll sell it at prices that will never be seen again, right? And so I don't think that it's the case that early adopters are unfairly rewarded, in particular if they didn't sell, right? So if somebody got Bitcoin at 10 cents and they're still holding it at $90,000, they have lived through so much volatility and they have absorbed so much risk that I think that they should be rewarded for the amount of risk that they have underwritten and that they've been essentially supporting the price by not selling. They've more than paid their dues. They're public servants. You know, it's almost an act of virtue. You can look at Satoshi Nakamoto. He has billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin that he has not moved. Now, maybe he's dead. Maybe he lost the private keys. But let's say he's still alive and he still has the private keys. And let's say somebody's saying, oh, Satoshi Nakamoto is being unfairly rewarded. I'd say, no, not at all. He's a great man that is not spending his Bitcoin, which means that everybody else's Bitcoins are worth more. And so for people who want to spend their Bitcoin today, Satoshi is helping them by not competing against them by selling his Bitcoin. And so in a way, I see the hodlers, the people holding Bitcoin, are performing an act of anonymous charity, right? Where they are anonymously giving purchasing power to today's spenders of Bitcoin without knowing them. And it's completely opposite of the other perspective.
Bitcoin is way too difficult to use.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin is difficult to use, to be honest. I think that if we look at the history of cars, cars started out as very difficult to use. You know, people had to work on their own cars. You know, if you look at the Model T, it was very challenging. And so I think that it comes down to education, but also improving wallet software, improving the tooling around it. It is less difficult to use than checks, for example, but it's still harder to use, I think, than cards. But it's catching up. So I've seen people use NFC cards to be able to spend sats on Lightning. And so I think that there's lots of experimentation happening so that it gets easier and easier.
Satoshi will return and crash Bitcoin's price.
That would be great. I'd be buying at that point. And, you know, it's his right to do so. If he wants to crash the price, that's, you know, Bitcoin's permissionless, so he can do that. The price is volatile, so the price is going to crash whether Satoshi comes back or not. And that's why people have to really think about Bitcoin within the context of their overall financial planning. And that's what my wife is focused on. She's a financial planner. She has lots of clients who are Bitcoiners, and she helps them plan for crashes so that they're not having to sell their Bitcoin at the worst moment. Rather, they're in a position to be able to continue to dollar cost average and buy more Bitcoin.
Let's heat things up. Bitcoin is bad for the environment.
Yeah. In every regard, Bitcoin is at least less bad for the environment than fiat is, if not good for the environment. First of all, from the perspective of e-waste, right? People talk about kind of the mining rigs becoming obsolete and then what happens to them. One is that they get repurposed to where, you know, you'll see mining rigs that are in places where electricity is free. And so it doesn't matter how old they are, how inefficient they are. People will use them because you can buy them for cheap and then you can plug them in and you can be continuing to extend their useful life. Second, they are far easier to recycle than cell phones, for example. Bitcoin mining rigs don't have batteries in them. Batteries are a major complexity in recycling. And they don't have screens in them. So screens also are more complicated to recycle. They're basically just aluminum and silicone. And those are the two easiest parts to recycle, and plastic, of course. That's from the hardware perspective. From the electricity perspective, there are throughout the world places where people are mining Bitcoin using coal-fired power plants. And if we want to reduce the amount of pollution from coal-fired power plants, which I think we do, because setting aside the debate about carbon and climate change, coal-fired power plants emit particulate matter. So PM10, PM2.5, those are terrible for our lungs. Sodium oxide, nitrous oxide, those are bad for humans. They're bad for animals, trees. They're bad for the environment. So we want less of that. Now, the solution there, I think, is a regulatory solution. And so there should be regulators that say either you stop using coal to generate electricity, or you start scrubbing, right, and filtering out the exhaust so that you're not emitting this pollution out into the air and creating a negative externality for everybody else who has to breathe it in. I'm fully in favor of that regulation. It just has absolutely nothing to do with Bitcoin mining, right? Because if we take the approach of, all right, we're going to stop air pollution from coal-fired power plants by regulating who is using electricity, we don't solve the problem, because the loads, the users of electricity, are actually not the sources of pollution. The sources of pollution are in the producers of electricity, and that's who should be regulated, so that then it creates an economic incentive to produce electricity using cleaner sources, whether it's natural gas, which produces way less harmful pollution than coal, or nuclear, or solar, or wind, or geothermal, or hydroelectric. So there's lots of ways to produce electricity that don't pollute like coal-fired power plants do, or like another big one is oil plants. So those are terrible, but getting those out of the supply chain is a regulatory challenge for the power producers. It's not, and should not be, of any concern to the consumers of power. Otherwise, it's like saying, if you shop at a supermarket and somebody who works there, if they slip and injure themselves, should the people who shop at the supermarket be liable for the injury of the worker at the supermarket? I mean, it would be absurd to say that, you know, shoppers should be doing their due diligence to make sure they don't shop at places where people accidentally injure themselves. And so it's kind of a new form of liability where they're trying to draw a tangential saying. And this actually started with the oil and gas companies. So the oil companies, when they started talking about carbon emissions, they started saying, well, we're not polluters. You're the polluter because you're paying us to pollute. And so it was a way for them to shift responsibility away from their activities and onto a broader constituency that is the voters, in order to divest themselves of the environmental liabilities that they were creating with their assets. It was clever of them. And unfortunately, the environmentalist movement was stupid enough to fall for it.
Bitcoin is mainly mined using coal power.
I think in some jurisdictions it is. What I'm most familiar with is the United States, and in particular, Texas. And in Texas, coal-fired power plants are now down to, I believe, 7% of the grid. And they're not economical. They're not economical because they because coal is expensive, first of all, and second of all, because of regulations from the EPA have made it less and less economical to operate coal plants in Texas. And so when activists attack Bitcoin mining, it's really pathetic that they attack it in Texas, where it's the cleanest Bitcoin mining in the world, and that they should be doing the opposite. They should be attacking Bitcoin mining in Kazakhstan or in China. But the reason why they don't do that is because if they went to China, if Greenpeace went to China and they protested coal plants in China, they would actually be murdered by the Communist Party. And so they don't have that freedom to do that. And so instead, they go to Texas, where they're paid by Ripple and XRP and Chris Larson. They were paid $5 million to pretend to be outraged by Bitcoin mining in the cleanest grid in the world.
Bitcoin mining is a waste of energy.
Is not a waste of energy, because that energy is going towards two ends that are very useful. The first end is providing transaction finality. So, you know, when people are sending Bitcoin transactions, they pay a transaction fee. That fee goes to the miners, and the miners compete to earn that fee. And so that's where the energy goes, is into having a competitive process for transaction processing. If the process was not competitive, then you would be in a situation like MasterCard or Visa, where they charge very high fees to consumers. And in fact, people complain about the high fees that MasterCard and Visa charge. And now the government regulates, through price controls, what the fees are for cards in the United States. It's crazy communism. And so the way to prevent that from happening is to have competition for including transactions in blocks. And the only way to do that in a decentralized manner is through energy consumption. The second source of revenue for Bitcoin miners, and thus for the energy consumption, is to compete for the new issuance of Bitcoin. And so that is what prevents monopoly profits from issuance, which is called seniorage in monetary economics. And when we look at the fiat system, so they have a monopoly on issuing currency, right? That's why counterfeiting is illegal. And so that way, only bankers and politicians are allowed to print dollars. When normal people try to print dollars, they face the risk of being killed by the government. This happened to George Floyd. George Floyd had a counterfeit $20 bill that he tried to spend, and then things spun out of control and he ended up dead. And so the fiat system is backed by the threat of violence, of saying, okay, if you try to compete against us, we'll kill you. Whereas the Bitcoin system is saying competition is good, having a monopoly is unethical, because it allows insiders, the bankers and politicians, to profit from the new issuance of dollars at the expense of the rest of society that has to pay the inflation tax. And then they go and blame greedy corporations, right? And they try to shift the responsibility to other parties, because they know that what they did was wrong. They can't justify it from an intellectual perspective. And so they have to go and scapegoat others and lie about it. And so it's a combination of theft and dishonesty. And Bitcoin, it's very useful and it's far more ethical than the alternative.
Why some people think using energy in general is morally wrong?
I think it comes down to primitivism. And so this is an ideology. It goes back to Rousseau, who's French, who had this idea of the noble savage. And so it was this idea that, civilization is bad, and that living in mud huts in a tribal society and kind of just rewinding the clock is better. And it's just it's a cognitive bias, and it's kind of a self-destructive one. It also manifested itself, with the Luddites being opposed to change, opposed to technology, new technologies. And that's, always going to be some percentage of the population that believe that. And it's fine for them to believe that. I think, for example, the Amish, right? Like, you can believe that, just go do that. You can go live that life. You don't have to be a part of modern society. The problem is when we give them political power, and then they start forcing their beliefs on others who actually want to improve their standard of living and improve the world for their kids.
So Bitcoin uses an old-fashioned energy-heavy system called proof of work. Like Ethereum, Bitcoin should move to proof of stake, a much greener alternative. And Ethereum has proven that is both politically and technically possible.
Yes, so there is actually a hard fork of Bitcoin that is proof of stake. And so if people want to use that, they can. It just has not gotten the market cap and the liquidity that Bitcoin has. It's not politically feasible. Otherwise, people would have switched to the proof of stake version of Bitcoin that already exists. And I think the reason why it's not politically feasible is also because of the engineering reason, which is that proof of stake is strictly worse than proof of work. And I think that it comes down to having a physical connection to the world. If somebody steals hash rate in a proof of work system, then all you have to do is flip an electrical switch and turn off those mining rigs, and then that hash rate disappears from the network, and the rightful owners of that hash rate can regain control, you know, because of whatever cybersecurity incident happened that their hash rate got stolen, right? So it's an individual problem when there's a hack. In proof of stake, if your private keys get hacked as a staker, you have to hard fork the protocol in order to recover the funds. There's no physical connection to the real world where you would be able to flip a switch and recover offline. We saw this with Ethereum DAO hack, where they were able to do an emergency hard fork and reverse the transaction and to undo the hack. And so proof of stake, I think, is fine for kind of a community coin like Ethereum, where they all know each other and they're all friends. But Bitcoin is a system for adversaries, right? So it's a global currency that's neutral. And so it would be impossible, I think, to undo a hack. Like, for example, Mt. Gox, when the Bitcoin were hacked at Mt. Gox, there was no way to reverse that. It's also, you know, that we saw a hack with other exchanges, Bitstamp, Bitfinex, and others. So that, I think, is a critical point. The other point is that by having the blockchain anchored in time through the proof of work mechanism, you don't have this problem of having multiple different parallel universes. Proof of stake, you don't have to commit to any particular chain. And so a proof of stake coin can have multiple parallel chains happening because there's no skin in the game in any particular timeline. And so then they have to do checkpointing, and checkpointing is centralized. So at the end of the day, proof of stake devolves into proof of authority. And the solution I've seen proposed to this, it was a set of researchers from Stanford who suggested that the way to solve the problem of proof of stake is to anchor it in Bitcoin's proof of work. So he called this Babylon. And I think that, you know, it just highlights why we need to have a proof of work chain in the world, and that proof of stake is just fundamentally not as secure as proof of work, just from first principles.
Bitcoin increases costs and reduces grid reliability for everyone.
Yes, so grid reliability, it's something that gets discussed a lot in the context of Texas. And in particular, because in 2021, there was a snowstorm that caused a week-long blackout. And I was at home with my family. We had our newborn daughter. It was a horrible situation because we also, not only did we lose electricity, we eventually lost water. And so we thought, you know, we would dehydrate to death in our home. And now, thankfully, the electricity came back. And so and the winter storm went away. But since then, it's been a hot topic in Texas politics of how do we make sure we have a reliable grid. What is certainly the case is that every instance that I've seen of a lack of reliability on the grid has to do with either power generation. So in the case of the winter storm in 2021, even the natural gas power plants froze. So the pipelines of gas into the power plants froze. And so they weren't able to get the gas into the power plant to create electricity. Second of all, you have problems at the transmission and distribution system where the power lines will fail because they have so much ice on them. The power line falls over, it snaps, and then electricity can no longer get from the power plant to the load. There's never been a situation where it's a problem of there's too much load. And that's what Bitcoin mining is. It's load. It really is a fabricated problem that is imagined by critics of Bitcoin mining as a hypothetical situation. And in particular, it's fabricated because Bitcoin miners are only profitable up to approximately $200 per megawatt. And to put that into perspective, a grid scale battery will generally turn on at $400 a megawatt. And so Bitcoin miners turn off very quickly when electricity prices start going up. Whenever there's more demand than there is supply, Bitcoin miners turn off very early. And so they stop being a part of the grid very early in the process of there not being enough electricity. And so in that regard, they are actually a very strong stabilizing force of turning off when there's going to be scarcity, and then also turning on when there's too much electricity. And people don't talk about when there's too much electricity. In Texas, it's not uncommon to have negative electricity prices because too much electricity is being produced from wind and solar.
Using flare gas for Bitcoin mining encourages oil and gas drilling because it turns wasted gas into profit for drillers.
I think the problem of flared gas is a real one. And so it can be addressed in a number of different ways. I think the degrowth people would say, you know, just stop oil now, right? So they go and throw paint on a painting and they go and glue their hands to the road and they say, we need to stop drilling for oil today. The reality is that that would cause mass death and starvation. And so what they're advocating for is the death of billions of people. And so I see them as borderline criminals, right? Because they're making criminal threats. So I think they should go to jail, but that's a different story. So then we have to look at, okay, we want oil and gas, but we want it to be done in a responsible manner, right? And so that's where we want to look at, okay, how can we minimize the environmental impact of oil and gas drilling? One is to make sure that oil and gas fields are electrified. So currently in West Texas, a lot of the drilling is done using pumps, and these pumps use generators that are fueled by diesel. And diesel is very polluting compared to natural gas, compared to wind and solar, obviously. And so it's actually a big project in Texas to build transmission to oil and gas producers so that they start using wind and sun to fuel their pumps to drill for oil and gas. And then when they drill for oil, they bring up gas as a byproduct of drilling. And so this is called associated gas. There's not any way for them to stop from getting the gas when they're drilling for oil, but gas is very cheap. And so now the cheap gas is a nuisance to them. It's that they need to get rid of. And there's three ways to get rid of it. One, you build a pipeline. So building a pipeline is expensive. It also has an environmental impact because you have to build through nature, right? Second is that you can just vent it. And so that's where they just blast it out into the air. They don't light it on fire or anything. They just vent methane. And, you know, when we look at the issue of carbon emissions, that is the worst thing for carbon emissions. It's the second worst thing. The worst thing is flying in airplanes, because flying in airplanes, you're emitting carbon emissions at a high altitude. We saw this with, after 9/11 and after COVID, when, you know, there was a lot less flying, that was the best moments for, you know, reducing carbon emissions. But nobody wants to talk about air travel and carbon emissions. So venting methane is bad. It's also just, I don't like it because it feels wasteful, right? We could use methane. It's a useful fuel. The third is flaring. So turning it and lighting it on fire. And so that's also bad for air quality. The fourth is to actually use it on site for power generation, to combust it, and then to filter the emissions. So you're minimizing the environmental impact and you're actually using it to produce electricity. And there the challenge is you have to have something that's going to use that electricity. It's far more electricity than they need for most purposes. And so, and then they don't have transmission, right? Now that might change in the future, but in remote locations, that might never change. And that's where it makes sense to bring a container of Bitcoin miners on site to use the natural gas that would otherwise be flared or vented. That, I think, actually, it's not so much that it helps pay for drilling for oil. It's the oil revenue is what pays for drilling for oil. So there's not like they need any additional incentive to do that. What it helps pay for is minimizing the environmental impact of the associated gas.
Right. So Bitcoin miners claim to be carbon neutral after purchasing carbon credits and renewable energy certificates.
I think that that is misleading because Bitcoin miners don't emit any CO2. And so if we're going to have a system of carbon credits or of cap and trade or taxing carbon, it should actually purely be about those who are physically emitting CO2. And so I think that it might make sense for a power plant that is using natural gas or coal or oil to buy carbon credits, maybe. Setting aside the validity of carbon credits themselves, right? Extending that market to consumers of electricity and consuming electricity, you know, electricity is clean, right? It's that's why a Tesla is zero emission. But the reason why bankers and politicians want to expand the carbon credit market to other participants is purely to make more money off of them. They're not actually trying to improve the environment. And so I see it as a scam personally. And that, you know, that we should stay focused on the fact that Bitcoin mining itself as a compute process does not emit any CO2.
Early Bitcoin adopters who made huge profits should pay for the environmental damage caused by mining Bitcoin.
Since there is no environmental damage, I think that, you know, they've got nothing to pay for. I think that a bigger issue would be, for example, looking at taxpayers, for example. So anybody who paid taxes for the invasion of Iraq, or should they be liable for the tremendous environmental damage that and human cost, right? I think 1 million Iraqis died. Should they be liable for it? I think that's a much more pertinent question than early Bitcoin adopters paying for fabricated fake environmental damage. And it's one that I think is widely rejected. I think that the people who should be held responsible is politicians who make the decisions, right? And so that's why we have a democratic process. So, for example, if you want less environmental impact, then we should vote for politicians who are actually going to solve problems instead of talking about solving problems or just blaming others for problems, which is what we currently have.
Bitcoin is the new fracking.
So I don't have anything against fracking. I think fracking is a completely legitimate technology, and that it's actually great for human flourishing. I think that the lower the cost of electricity, the lower the cost of energy, the more we can improve our standard of living. And so, yeah, I think fracking is good.
Bitcoin is not regulated.
On two levels, that's completely wrong because Bitcoin nodes regulate Bitcoin. And so if you disagree with how Bitcoin is regulated by the nodes, then you have to persuade the other nodes that your regulations are better than theirs. And so that means that you have to do work. And that's why Bitcoin's decentralized. Otherwise, if one person could decide what the regulations ought to be for Bitcoin, then it would be centralized and it would just be another fiat system. Second, it's regulated at the on and off ramps between fiat currency and Bitcoin. So if you want to buy and sell Bitcoin, unfortunately, there's a lot of regulations around that. And it's mostly because they want to keep people in the fiat system, right? It's like the Berlin Wall. They have a Soviet communist system of their fiat monopoly, and they don't want people escaping it. And so they've created lots of regulatory problems to try to prevent that from happening.
Governments will ban Bitcoin.
So governments can only ban themselves from using Bitcoin. And really the challenge there is that because Bitcoin's decentralized, it's very easy for Bitcoin to go underground and to be a part of the black market or the gray market. And so on top of that, governments are always competing against each other. And so if one government bans Bitcoin, like let's say China bans Bitcoin, and then they don't have any Bitcoin and all the Bitcoin go abroad and Bitcoin's value increases, well, they've only harmed themselves. And so it really is a question of, you know, governments should think about it from the perspective of game theory of whoever bans Bitcoin is only slowing down their adoption, and whoever adopts it faster will benefit from Bitcoin sooner than anyone else.
The Bitcoin network can be shut down by governments.
So they would have to essentially shut down the internet to accomplish that. And I think the challenge there, it comes down to the fact that governments derive their legitimacy from the people. And so if they engage in tyrannical actions that are opposed to the people, what we've seen historically is that there's a violent revolution and then people get their heads chopped off. And so I think that it's not in the interests of governments to try to attack their own people. I think they have to accept the will of the people and adapt to it. And the faster they adapt to it, the less they lose in the process.
Bitcoin has been created by the CIA or aliens. This one is unclear.
Yeah, so because we don't know Satoshi's identity, there's lots of conspiracy theories that pop up around that. Personally, I don't think it's important because it's open source, and so it doesn't really matter to me who created it. What matters to me is that I can actually verify that what they created is something that I want to use. It goes back to the question of, are they going to sell their Bitcoin? Well, it's well within their right to do so. Bitcoin's permissionless. We can't stop them from doing that. So if it's the CIA, I'd like to thank them for creating that technology. If it's aliens, I'd like to meet them. It sounds really interesting. But I think that ultimately it was probably just a normal person.
Bitcoin is not decentralized because the developers change the protocol whenever it suits them.
That was the case at the beginning. So if we look at 2009, Satoshi Nakamoto was the only miner on the network. He was the only node on the network. He had all the Bitcoin, and he would release the software as a binary without the source code. And so he at the beginning was running essentially a proprietary system. Since then, it's been increasing amount of decentralization. And now people are complaining about the difficulty of changing Bitcoin. So there's developers who have ideas about new protocol upgrades that they want and that are not getting a lot of momentum, and that they're complaining that this is an upgrade that they want, but that nobody else is doing it. And so it's causing what they call ossification of Bitcoin not changing anymore. And then they have all sorts of reasons for why that's a problem. And so I think that there will always be a criticism of Bitcoin changes too much when it changes, and then that it doesn't change enough when it doesn't change. Ultimately, what we have to do is evaluate changes on a case-by-case basis and decide whether a change is providing such an increase in value to the users that we justify the risk of changing the system versus not.
Bitcoin gets hacked all the time.
So private keys get hacked all the time, and it's really important to follow best practices from a cybersecurity perspective, but that's not really Bitcoin getting hacked in the sense that the protocol is operating as expected. It's just that somebody did not secure their private keys correctly, and that they should learn to use a hardware wallet. They should learn to use multi-sig, because if you follow best practices, then your Bitcoin don't get hacked.
Anyone with enough computing power can take over the Bitcoin network.
This is true, but it's only in a temporary sense, because Bitcoin, from a game theory perspective, it's not one game. It's several iterations of a game. And so it's an infinite iteration of games where essentially, even if you control all of the hash rate today, if you abuse that position and start excluding transactions from blocks, which is what you can do with that control, then those transactions will go into the backlog of the mempool, transaction fees will increase, and then that will attract new hash rate. And so Hashrate is an open set. New Hashrate can always come online and compete. And so even if you have 100% market share today, you could have 1% market share tomorrow if lots of competition comes in and, you know, essentially is incentivized by your bad behavior to come in and make a profit.
Quantum computers will break Bitcoin's security.
So I think that that's the case for ECDSA and Schnorr signatures that are securing UTXOs. And so we want post-quantum cryptography to replace those eventually. I don't think it would break SHA-256. I think that it would just cause the difficulty adjustment to happen more quickly. But as far as I know, quantum computing is still 80% science fiction. And so we'll wait and see what happens. There's cryptographers working on post-quantum cryptography already. I don't see it as being an existential threat to Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is outdated technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bitcoin's cutting-edge technology. So proof of work, nobody has found anything better than proof of work. They've only found worse solutions to that problem. Schnorr is, you know, I haven't seen any signature schemes that have technological advantages over Schnorr. And usually what they're talking about from a technology perspective is that they want to be able to issue tokens on the Bitcoin blockchain. And that to them is innovative. I see that as just it's not innovative. It's just, it's pollution on the blockchain. And that it's something that we should want to disincentivize. It comes down to a philosophical difference between the people who want to issue tokens and those who want to fix the money and fix the world.
Bitcoin is the new oil.
Humanity benefits by having an abundance of oil, right? So we want to have as much oil as possible at as low of a price as possible. Bitcoin is a monetary asset, and so we want it to have finite scarcity. And the ideal, you know, money supply is 21 million Bitcoin, and we want it to be worth as much as possible. And so in that regard, it's the opposite of oil. But, you know, I'll defend the analogy, right, which is that when oil was first discovered, it was a nuisance. So when people bought land in Texas, for example, they would try to buy land that did not have oil on it because it was bad for the horses and the cattle. They would get stuck in the oil. And so it took technological advancement for people to realize that the oil was valuable and that they could actually use it for its utility. So I think it's the same with Bitcoin in some regards, where people don't yet understand the full value of Bitcoin. And so we're still at a stage where people don't yet understand the value of the land, right? Which is the BTC.
Bitcoin is just a bubble waiting to burst.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And so I think that that's looking at the price chart. But when we look at the software engineering fundamentals, it's clear that if we cross the utility of the system from a software perspective with the total addressable market, it's the opposite of a bubble, right? We're at less than 1% adoption. And so I think that the real bubble is fiat currencies and debt that is going to be burst by Bitcoin's adoption.
It's too late to invest in Bitcoin.
I don't think it'll ever be too late to invest in Bitcoin. It's certainly not too late today. I think we're still very early because we're at less than 1% adoption. But even when we're at 100% adoption, the economy will keep growing and the purchasing power of Bitcoin will keep growing. And you'll still have the fundamentals of it's seizure resistant, it's permissionless. And so it'll still make sense to hold Bitcoin, even if its value from a purchasing power is not increasing.
Bitcoin is too volatile.
I think Bitcoin is too volatile for some people, right? Where if they need to spend money tomorrow, it's probably not a good idea. But for people who have the ability to live through that volatility, then they just don't care about the volatility, right? And one way to hedge against that is to not, you know, hold 100% Bitcoin, hold some fiat currency for your short-term spending needs, and then hold Bitcoin for long-term savings.
A new Bitcoin will pop up.
Lots of new Bitcoins have popped up, tens of thousands of them. And the reality is that Bitcoin is engineered for reliability, and any new system is generally engineered for innovation. And so they try to differentiate themselves from Bitcoin, and they try to be different from Bitcoin in order to attract adoption that would otherwise go towards Bitcoin. So because of that, they end up having to sacrifice reliability, and it's all about trade-offs. So if people want to have really innovative ways of trading pictures of monkeys, then there's, you know, other chains for that. But if they want to just have the most reliable money in the world, then it just doesn't make sense to use anything other than Bitcoin.
I've got a few left. Bitcoin can be counterfeited.
So it can be counterfeited. So for example, you know, people try to pass off like Bitcoin Cash or Bitcoin Satoshi's vision as BTC. And they try to confuse people with marketing and stuff. So every time that it's forked, it creates a new network. When we look at the Bitcoin system itself, there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoin. When we look at the wider universe of forks of Bitcoin or new cryptocurrencies, or Pierre coin, for example, you know, there's an unlimited supply and they're all diluting each other out. The only way to prevent counterfeiting with Bitcoin is to run your own Bitcoin node. There's no laws against counterfeiting Bitcoin. So it really comes down to the user's responsibility of verifying their transactions using their own node.
Bitcoin is a scam.
Bitcoin being a scam, I think it usually ends up being the case that that angle is about like it being a Ponzi scheme, essentially, where the new adopters are buying out old adopters. That's generally a description of money, where money is just changing hands, but it's never actually being consumed. And so that, I think, is just a property of money. In that regard, it's kind of the case that it's the opposite of a scam, because when we look at ways people want to consume, there's a lot of scams out there, you know, whether it's actual gambling at a casino in Las Vegas. Well, lots of ways people are persuaded by marketing into wasting their money.
Is there any you'd like to add?
I did want to add one more thing on Bitcoin being a scam, which is that scams usually promise returns, right? And so they'll say that, like, you're going to earn 5% a month. Bitcoin promises volatility, as you know, it's one of the biggest criticisms of Bitcoin. And so I think that the argument of Bitcoin being a scam and Bitcoin being too volatile are actually two opposites that cancel each other out.
And lastly, what would you like people to remember from this conversation?
That there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. And that when we look at our sources of information, unfortunately, the mainstream media has its very strong biases. And so it used to be the case that journalism was about verifying the truth and then publishing the truth. Today, journalism is about finding ways to justify narratives. And so they'll have the narrative and then they'll go and try to find facts that support the narrative, or they'll twist facts in order to support a narrative.
Pierre, thank you for everything, for clarifying all this, for your time. I've learned a lot today. Where can people follow you and your work?
I'm on Twitter at Bitcoin Pierre. I'm on Nostr as well, at Pierre Rochard. Also on LinkedIn. Just watch out for the impersonators.
It's been amazing having you on the pod. Looking forward to having you next time.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.